Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. Later on in the show, we'll look back at the Mars Pathfinder mission, which landed a tiny rover named Sojourner on Mars 25 years ago. We'll be joined by NASA JPL Imaging Operations Engineer Doug Ellison, who currently works on the Curiosity rover mission. But first, NASA recently announced final awards for a competition it holds to promote science and engineering for future space-applicable technologies at minority-serving institutions. Called the MSI Accelerator Program, it's designed to engage a more diverse future workforce. We'll hear later from some of the recipients from Fayetteville State University in North Carolina and their mentor, Dr. Sambit Bhattacharya. Here to tell us about the MSI Accelerator Program is Tom Swick. He's the manager of the Space Technology Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. Tom, welcome to Blue Dot.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're here to talk about this story that I saw about NASA selecting minority-serving institution proposals to receive support. And this looked really interesting to me, and I'd like to know, what was the genesis of this program? Can you describe the basics of it for us, like, you know, give us the elevator speech, what it is, and how did it get started?
Sure, Dave. It was interesting because we, over the years, about the last 4 or 5 years, the small companies have really blossomed in the space sector. So traditionally, there's the big primes and there's NASA working to build systems for space. But over the last several years, a lot of small companies have started up. A lot of, if you heard of SmallSats, CubeSats, you know, SpaceX Sure. kind of started as a small company in the past and and really took off. And so there's a growing group of small companies that are developing technologies that we do not normally do at NASA or at JPL, and we want to get access to them and help them move forward in the space environment. So we started a few years ago what we call accelerators. They're ways for small companies to come together, gather a little bit of funding. There's some companies that help these startups get going. And they form business plans. They get taught a little bit through mentoring and through connectivity with other executives and so forth and other companies to build their company around their great idea. And as that moved on, we found value in it. We found it useful to be able to work with these small companies. And you know, it's a kind of a long term proposition, but they start bringing value to the folks at JPL. And in working with actually with NASA headquarters, the idea came up that there's a probably a group of organizations, the MSIs, that are not involved right now, and we wanted to reach out to them. So it was a group at what's called the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters, a gentleman Mike C. Bloom, that came up with the idea to say, hey, let's just do one of these startup accelerators specifically for minority serving institutions. And so that was the genesis. And so, you know, some ideas and proposals went out to talk to the MSIs.
Give us a sense of how many institutions applied for the, how many teams were there that applied for this?
This first time around, it was somewhat less than 10 to get going that applied. And this is a startup process to get going here. NASA is funding three of them. JPL is sort of working with NASA to operate the program, and we're funding around three of them right now. And in fact, they're right now inside an accelerator. It's called their word. They're going to spend about 12 weeks as this group of a cohort, which will then develop their idea, develop their plan, and then they come to JPL. They're going to be at JPL for 2-3 days. Near the end of their accelerator phase, this 12-week, think of it as a small company school, university to get going. And then they'll come to JPL for 2 or 3 days, and they'll work with subject matter experts, some specific people in their fields. You know, they'll get the whole tour of JPL. They'll meet a whole range of people. With the three now are from universities. And so we're also very interested in interfacing them. We have intern programs, we have hiring programs. And so it's a great way for JPL to access more more of the technology and the ideas in the MSIs.
And talent.
And talent, of course, yeah.
And so tell us a bit about the competition that was held. So if there was 10 applicants and three selected, how did it go? How did they go about, you know, competing for these spots?
Yeah, at this level, you like to keep it, relatively simple and easy. And for any kind of accelerator, these startup programs, it's about the idea and about the people. And so they wrote more or less a 3-4 page white paper. So they wrote the idea paper, and they sent it along. And then there was a group of folks that reviewed it. I was one of them. You review the ideas, and they were all generally very good ideas. And then you have to make the hard decision based on what you could actually do in the program. And so we walked through that process. And at the end of it, it's very important. There's something called a pitch day, where, in fact, the teams came to NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and there's a famous auditorium there on the first floor that all the, great announcements of NASA are put together. And we had a pitch day where they actually came in, and they, for 15 minutes or so, they have to pitch their idea. So it's sort of a Shark Tank, if you think of that, the TV version of it.
Yeah, okay.
And and so they come in, and there's, the review board's there, with some folks, and you ask some tough questions to them to, pull out, what the idea is and what the team is, who the folks are. You make it fun, it's short, it's easy. And then, as I mentioned, you have to make the hard decision, based on what you could do in the program.
And then if you're selected, if you're one of those three teams, what do you get?
Yeah, there's number one, you get some funds right up front, so that helps.
Always
you.
Good.
Always good. You get some funds up front to keep you going, and then the main thing is this 12-week accelerator.
And where does that take place?
It's a mix. Right now, it's a virtual one. In the past, if we weren't in this terrible pandemic, all teams would actually come, in this case, to Los Angeles. And that's part of the program, is that you're funded, your travel's paid and the hotel and whatnot, and you all sit in one spot. And then you bring in, CEOs from other companies, you bring in venture capital folks, you bring in, NASA JPL guys that have the subject matter experts and the ideas to help with them. They walk through a 12-week process. It's like a boot camp. You could talk about your idea. You have a whole connection into a network of folks that could help you. You have a understand how NASA works, and so then you're kind of kicked out of the nest a little bit to move forward and take that idea forward.
Okay, well, why don't you tell us about the three winning teams and just briefly about their proposals?
So there are three ideas that came forward, and they came from all over the country, from Boston to LA to California. And when the first one is, drones are very big right now, and they're really kind of blooming on what you could do with them. You see them around the streets, they're hobbyists, and hopefully you saw a helicopter on our Mars Perseverance rover.
Yeah, Ingenuity.
Ingenuity is flying. It just, I think, flew for the 29th time on Mars. And so there's a path forward for these, and you'd like to have many of them. But you need to charge them. That's one of the tough things. Ingenuity can only fly for several minutes because of the amount of power it has, batteries that have to be recharged by the sun. And so the first one is a wireless network sensors for autonomous recharging. So you could actually kind of come close to a charging station. Think of your electric car charging, but you don't plug in. You don't have to plug in. You could just kind of sit close to it, and it will wirelessly charge your drone. So it makes it very simple. If you have many of them, it really simplifies what you could do forward. And if you could push this forward, you could see where that would make a difference in not only here on Earth, but in on the planets where we're going.
And that's the group from Massachusetts?
Yeah, that's from Boston. Yeah.
Okay. How about the others?
Another one is from California here, from CSUN, Cal State University Northridge, and it shows the diversity of it. This one is more about computer languages. The whole big idea around this startup, you always give these initial startup teams a topic to work from, and it kind of down selects why there's only 10. You give them a topic that we want to work to, and this one was about autonomy, about self-driving something, self-driving cars, self-driving rovers, self-driving drones, and what it takes to do that. So the second one here from Cal State University Northridge is about a language which helps this autonomous system, as they call it, to come together. So how do you tell a self-driving car what to do if it's going to do it on its own? And so the folks here at Cal State, they wanted to come up with a different computer language specifically for this application. How do you tell it what to do, and then how do you know it did what you told it to do? Something called V&V, validation and verification of the actual command sequence. So it's a big problem. It's a really tough problem. Self-driving car companies, the Teslas of the world, have to deal with this. And we have to deal with it in space when we go to Mars. Perseverance, we could tell it what to do. But did it really do what we asked? And how do we know it did what we asked? And so they have a nice little way to prototype and try to do some software development.
And then finally, there's a team from North Carolina.
And then, we went across the country. We got one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and then we're in North Carolina. And again, this is sort of software, hardware based. And back to I always like to use the self-driving car example or the rover example, that you have a lot of sensors. And, you know, there's cameras, there's radars when you drive today. And all that information comes back, and then you have to act on that information. So they're working on something called an inference engine from this perception. That's the title. And they're saying, well, how do you infer what to do from this information from the cameras and the radars? You know, not a simple thing. Your eyes just do it normally. Your brain figures it out from your eyes. And now, you have a camera. And, well, you know, what do you turn left? Do you turn right? And how do you do that in an efficient, fast way so you don't run into something as you're moving along? And so they're working this whole problem here in Arkansas on, again, it's kind of a mixture of the software and the hardware. It's a fascinating piece of work.
And when will this go again? Like next year? Is this a yearly program?
Yeah. In fact, we're discussing right now, NASA headquarters is looking to do this on a yearly basis. To reach out specifically to the minority serving institutions. But there are other startups going on also, just generally, startups in different areas, boot camps that we're trying to put together just generally in different other areas of space exploration. And so, MSIs could join into those also. And we'll probably do the MSI challenge again next year.
And I also see that this is, as you mentioned before, a partnership between various branches of NASA technology offices and, of course, JPL. But then there's also this company called Starburst. Could you just briefly tell us what that is and what their role is?
Yeah. So these are very kind of unique companies. And what they do is they help you manage, finding the MSIs, writing the topic, such that in a manner that a small company, or in this case, the university, in a manner that they understand, they manage the Shark Tank event back in NASA headquarters, because they do many of these throughout the year. They then actually operate the boot camp, the accelerator, as it's called. They operate the accelerator camp for the 12 weeks. They have a connection with the venture capitalists and CEOs and mentors, and they bring them in. And then they arrange at the end of the day is a demo day, they call it, where the three teams that's graduation, they come out and they tell you exactly what they want to do. And, they're very good at it now after 12 weeks of education, and it's sort of a graduation day. And so they put all this together for us when we give them the technical idea and some mentors and subject matter experts.
Yeah, it sounds like a great program. And I can just foresee that, within a few years, some of these people will be working for NASA.
100%. So, I mean, when we see like something like this, number one, you see the talent, you see the value, you see the, in this case, the universities, the professors and their students. So the students, right? They come, And it would be not uncommon for the students to be part of this program and then come into a mentorship, an internship over the summer, and then, you know, move into, for example, JPL here as a full-time employee down the road. You know, that's the first big deal about it. The second is, you know, there's some ideas out there. You know, there's many great ideas out there, and you want to tap them for space exploration for the nation. And this is a way to get at those ideas and start working with them.
Well, Tom Swick, manager of space technology at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, thanks for sharing this story about this accelerator program for minority serving academic institutions. It sounds like a great program, and best of luck with it.
It's my pleasure to talk about it, and you know, happy to talk about other things down the road with you too. Appreciate it.
Thanks to our guest, Tom Swick, talking about the NASA Minority Serving Institutions Accelerator Program. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us, and we'll hear from some of the winners of the MSI Accelerator Competition. And we're back to our look at a special NASA program called MSI Accelerator, a competition designed to encourage more future engineers and scientists coming from minority-serving institutions. Our next guests are Dr. Sambit Bhattacharya from Fayetteville State University in North Carolina and two of his students, Grace Vincent and Colly Crawford. Welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much, Dave, for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to start with you, Sambit. You've gotten grants before from NASA. Could you tell us about, does this one feel different to you? Did it have like a different feel to it when you found out that your group was one of the winners for the Minority Serving Institutions Accelerator Program?
Yes, absolutely. It felt different because I'm more used to academics grants, which is, you know, a lengthy proposal writing process. Then you wait for the decision from the funding agency. And then the expectation is you do some research, academic research, and the main output of academic research is research publications, perhaps software, because we are in the computer science discipline, and so on. But here, this is different because there was not, let's say, a very lengthy proposal writing process. It was a 5-pager as compared to like 25 pages for other proposals. And the review process was very short. And the winners were announced, were invited to DC. And that's where we did the pitch, which was actually a very short presentation compared to more lengthy academic presentations. Now, the outcome and the expectation from this is that we will create a university-based startup. And that is completely different from other grants that I'm, that I've gotten in the past.
And let's talk a bit about what you actually got the grant for, because it's quite a mouthful. Autonomous systems with on-demand inference from perception pipelines. Can you break that down to us into common English and let us know, what does that mean?
Oh, absolutely. Let me try to explain it with an example. Let's imagine we're driving on a road, right? And we all drive on a road, and sometimes unexpected things happen. But most of the times, not much unexpected is going on. But when we see something unexpected, let's say a deer about to cross the road in front of us, and then we pay more close attention. So you can think of this as a cognitive load on our mind, where if there's something that is interesting happening in our field of view, we pay more attention to it, or we, let's say, put more cognitive load on it to just to process that information and to react to it. So our core idea is to have robotics and multiple robot systems working together to intelligently handle the cognitive load when something unexpected happens. And I'm using the word unexpected, but let me also say that special is another word. Special or interesting is another word. So if you think of NASA's mission in space, exploring the moon and Mars, what NASA is looking for with robotics is unusual geological features, maybe even signs of ancient life. So if a robot comes across such a life, I mean, across such an interesting place or geological feature, it should be paying more attention to that place and drilling and performing experiments. Now, does that happen all the time? It is very rare. Of course, it's very rare because most of the time, the scenery in such extraterrestrial locations is monotonous. You see dirt and maybe some scattered rocks and sky. So if the robot can save energy in processing that data that is coming in through its camera and other sensors more intelligently and not devote too much computing power to them, then it would have saved some onboard energy because the robots are really driven by batteries and maybe also solar power. So if it can conserve that energy, then it's a more intelligent handling of the resources of the robot. Now, if you think about a multi-robot system, which is multiple robots working together. Now, we can be more intelligent about that because when you have a multi-robot system scattered across a particular place, each robot has its own unique vantage point. And from that unique vantage point, it has a different view of the environment. So if we can exploit that also, because one robot in this multi-robot system can be closer to the interesting geological place than the other robots. So perhaps we can allocate that task of processing the data, which is interesting, to that robot, which is at that better vantage point to observe that scenery. So what we're trying to do here is do it for one robot, then scale it up for a multi-robot system. And that is pretty much our core idea.
And how would you go about having the robots sense when something is unusual? What are some of the algorithms or whatever you use to come up with ways to, like, this is an unusual feature?
Wonderful question. So this is based on artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is the attempt of computer science to do tasks in computing machinery that are equivalent or similar to what humans do. So human perception is a very important thing because we perceive scenery, we react to it. So can we build perception in robots? Well, how is that done? The equivalent of our eyes for a robot is a robot's own camera, which is attached to the robot. But typically nowadays, more advanced robots have onboard computing power. So they have a computer within them. And this computer runs artificial intelligence algorithms, which are, another word for that is machine learning models, because a machine learning model is really some sort of an algorithm which has learned patterns from data or training data. And we are looking at a very specific kind of machine learning algorithm called a deep neural network, which is really the most hot topic in machine learning nowadays. And deep neural network are really these big algorithms with a lot of numbers or not a number crunching that these algorithms have to do. So this takes up a lot of computing power. And if we can reduce the amount of computing power that is dedicated to run a deep neural network on a, let's say, edge computing device, really means a small computer that is embedded inside a robot, then overall we would have saved or conserved battery power or would have used energy more efficiently and more intelligently. So to come back to your question, the software that we're running is really called a deep neural network model, which sucks up a lot of computing power if you don't, use it in an intelligent way.
And I would assume that as time goes by, the robots using your programming would also be learning. And so if they found something that they thought was unusual, only to find out later from, scientific analysis back here that, no, actually that's, just a common piece of chert or whatever. Would they be able to learn as they go and then get even better at it on the surface?
That is an excellent question, because what we are now considering, or what you'd asked me, is can the robots learn on the fly while being deployed, while actually doing its work? Can the deep neural network learn? And so this is so far not yet possible in a robust way. So people are attempting this in the research field, but generally how it happens is the deep neural network is trained, and that is a separate process. Then it is deployed in computers and robots and small computers within robots, et cetera. But once the deep neural network has been deployed, then training it from incoming data or new data is kind of still a difficult area of work. And not much has been done. People are attempting it, but this is certainly one of those areas we would also be interested in working.
Well, I'm sure Grace and Kali will have that conquered in about 20 years.
Absolutely. I'm very hopeful.
Let me start with you, Grace Vincent. When did you first get involved with Dr. Bhattacharya's lab there? And what got you interested in this in the first place? How did you get to be there?
Oh, gosh. Probably 2 to 3 years ago now is when I started working with Dr. Bhattacharya and his lab. He approached me. He was my professor first, of course, in a course about computer architecture. And he approached me one day after class, asked if I was interested in joining his lab. At that time, you know, I think I was a sophomore in college. So the concept of AI, machine learning, was still just so fresh for me. So getting into it, I knew I enjoyed looking at data and the predictability that we can kind of extract from data. So it just felt like a great next step for me.
And Kali Crawford, same question for you. How did you come to be at the lab, and how did you first get interested in this, and tell us about your pathway here?
Yes, I first joined Dr. Bhattacharya's lab, and I believe it was February of 2020. I joined through a separate program that recommended me to do research with him over the summer. And I began working with a project we were working on at the time, TurtleBots. I was very interested in robots, which is what we were working on. And well, for computers, me and my brother have always had a very deep love and interest in computers and electronics since we were growing up. So that's what I went to school for, which was computer science. As far as artificial intelligence, I really got into that after I joined the lab, and I found it very interesting teaching robots and machine computers how to think with certain data sets and building algorithms with that and around that.
And Sambit, I know there must be so many students coming through your classrooms through the courses you teach there, but you obviously saw something special in Grace and Kali and the other students on your team. What is it you look for? What is it that you notice when you go, this is a person I want in my lab?
So I think it begins with observation in a classroom. I generally recruit students from my classes. As Grace said, I observed something special in her when she was attending my class on computer architecture. I generally tend to see, academic grades are important, but they're not the only thing, as we know. But, you know, that's a strong indicator of other things. Commitment and perseverance and so on. So then I would also look out for interaction, how well they're interacting with their peer students, and asking good questions. Because I think curiosity, inherent urge to learn, the drive to understand and do great things, that is really what I'm looking out for. And not really that much of grades, but really the drive, the inner drive to learn and do great things. And the curiosity comes with that. So,
yeah. And let me turn that around. So I'll start with you, Kali, this time. What is it that you enjoy about your professor? What makes him special to you?
I really enjoy the way Dr. Bhattacharya teaches. He's very hands-on, very... he'll give you a project and put you on a team of people. And he'll always say, he'll do like a little bit of training first, obviously, to get you used to the programming and the computers and the science and everything. But he'll really just throw you in there, not in the deep end, but make sure you get a hands-on approach to the project. Because I personally, that worked really well for me because I learn by doing, and so do many of the other students in the lab.
Ah, okay. And what about you, Grace? What is it about your professor that makes you enjoy learning at Fayetteville State University?
Yeah, I have to agree with Kali on that. Dr. Bhattacharya, he definitely pushes you to be more curious about a lot of things. And it's very learning-focused research. we do have goals in mind, but the pathway to reach those goals are not set. So it's kind of student driven, but Dr. Bhattacharya definitely does take a hands-on approach in helping us reach our goals.
And for both of you, when did you find out that your team had won this grant? And just tell us about, you know, how exciting was that for you? So I'll start with you, Grace.
I felt confident going to DC that I thought we had a great pitch. But I truthfully didn't know until it was announced on stage at the NASA headquarters that we had won. So that was incredibly exciting because, one, that just gets the Fayetteville State University name out there, which is incredible for the university, but also it's a little validating in the effort that has been gone into this work and into the lab. So just a combination of a couple of different gratifying emotions for sure.
How about you, Kali?
I'm going to agree with Grace a little bit here and say it was very, I felt very proud to come from an HBCU and see that we had won this grant. It was very rewarding, very invigorating for me personally. I enjoyed it a lot. And I had learned also on stage when we had won the grant. And I'll also say that it was, also like Dr. B said earlier, this was the first grant that I was actually a part of that we had won. So this was very huge for me.
Oh, yeah. I bet that was very exciting. Okay. Moving forward, have you guys started the training yet, the actual program?
Yes, we have, Dave. So we have gone through several of these seminars, and we're learning quite a bit of information.
And for the students, how are you enjoying that so far?
I would say that it's definitely different than the academic research side of things.
How so?
The training seminars, they kind of focus a lot more on the business side of things. So that's kind of, I think, Dr. Bhattacharya, you mentioned in the beginning how this grant or this seed award is different than previous grants from NASA that we've received. Because previous ones had focused primarily on the academic research side of things, where this one is encouraging us to develop a startup. So that's very business oriented. How do we identify potential or customers? How do we raise more capital? So those kinds of things. So it's been really interesting.
Very, very much realistic, real life stuff that you need to know once you leave school.
Right.
What about you, Kali?
I'm going to have to agree again. The classes are very business oriented. The logistics of running a company of this type, very informative. The computer science part, I understand completely. I will admit I am struggling to grasp some of the more complicated business stuff, but I am excited to learn about it and very interested in all the information that they are generously sharing with us.
And finally, Dr. Bhattacharya, as you look at the future and these students that you have, what is it that makes you most proud about working at an institution like Fayetteville State and the students that you have, especially the ones that we got to talk to today, who are just amazing?
Yes, I will agree with you on that. You have amazing students. So what I particularly like about working in a HBCU is it feels like a family. It really feels like a family. And we support each other. I have very good relations with my colleagues. Then none of them are here in this call, but I can tell you that I really have very good relations with my colleagues, and the classes are small. The student interaction, the fact that I can go up to a student and engage him or her in more advanced work, that is very special. And I also am knowledgeable, having been in the university for a long time. The backgrounds that the students come from, the less financially secure backgrounds, and the fact that they have to do jobs, balance family while taking classes, and doing research also, and how much potential they have for brilliance, for really being brilliant people. But then there's the financial side of practical matters that have to be taken care of. So grants, and let me say that, the grants are extremely useful because they provide stipend money to support students so that they can devote their time and energy to advanced work instead of just trying to make ends meet. So stipend money from grants, and grants giving us money to buy equipment for a lab, these are extremely important things. So yes, and the fact that we have been getting grants and developing capacity is very helpful.
Yes, and which is exactly the point of the Minority Serving Institution Accelerator program that NASA is involved with. So it seems like just everything's been a perfect fit for you guys.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay, well, I so enjoyed talking to all three of you, and best of luck in the future, and congratulations for sure, Dr. Bhattacharya and Grace Vincent and Colly Crawford from Fayetteville State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we'll be joined by NASA JPL imaging engineer Doug Ellison to talk about the very first Mars rover mission, Mars Pathfinder, 25 years ago. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. 25 years ago, the fairly new experience known as the Internet was abuzz with pictures coming from the surface of Mars. The Mars Pathfinder mission with its tiny Sojourner rover began the current era of Mars exploration that Curiosity and Perseverance are the stars of today, as they search for evidence that Mars was once a habitable planet. Joining us to talk about the Pathfinder mission is Doug Ellison. Doug is currently the engineering camera team lead for Curiosity. But as you'll hear, Doug has a very soft spot in his heart for Pathfinder and Sojourner. Doug Ellison, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's a pleasure to be back. Nice to speak to you, Dave.
Well, before we get to talking about our topic, which is Pathfinder, you mentioned when we were just chatting before going on air here that it's been interesting times on Mars the last few days. Could you share with us a little bit about what's going on up there with the rover?
So, yeah, we have our two rovers currently very busy on Mars. We've got Perseverance over at Jezero Crater. Meanwhile, in Gale Crater on the project I work on, Curiosity, we are navigating our way through some pretty challenging terrain. This is the terrain we always dreamed we'd be exploring when we picked this landing site more than 10 years ago. And we're now right up in the foothills of Mount Sharp, this huge layering of outcrops and geological wonder. And it's pretty tricky because we need to speak to our Mars orbiters to get data home. We need to listen to the Earth to get our commands in the morning. And well, radio waves and giant mountains don't mix very well. One won't tend to go through the other. So we've been having to pick our way very carefully, not just around the physical obstacles in front of us, but also dodging essentially the shadows of the hills in terms of radio communications. So it's an extra layer of challenge, but the Curiosity team will be celebrating 10 years on Mars this Friday, and we're getting pretty good at doing what we do.
Wow, what another anniversary, 10 years on Mars for Curiosity. Hard to believe.
It's extraordinary. It feels like yesterday that it was landing.
Yeah, well, 2012 doesn't seem that like that long ago, but because there's so much happened in the world, 10 years seems like, I don't know, 100.
We've been through a lot. I mean, I've only been on the project for 6 years, so I've only been with Curiosity for a little over half its surface mission. But I was there on landing day driving graphics for NASA television, and I didn't dream that I'd end up being a part of the project, and certainly didn't dream I'd be running the planning team. But we've got an incredible team of engineers and scientists who figure out what we're going to do with the rover, keep it safe, keep it busy, and keep it discovering new and amazing things.
Well, these rovers, Curiosity and Perseverance, and then before them, Spirit and Opportunity, they all owe their lineage, if you will, to a plucky little mission called Mars Pathfinder and the itty-bitty Sojourner rover 25 years ago in 1997. Where were you? Do you remember that mission?
I remember it very, very clearly. I I'd always loved space, but I was sat at home in rural England at the time, in the little town of Tetbury in the Cotswolds, and watching on BBC TV to see the coverage of landing. And I was transfixed the moment this mission came to be. And the first little color pictures came down, and I hadn't used the internet until then. And so I found a small company in the town we lived in, and cycled into the town and bought internet access by the hour, and spent several hours trying to download these pictures onto floppy disks to then take them home and print them out. And the rest of the people at this little company were so fascinated with all these pictures from Mars that they didn't actually bill me for the couple of hours I'd bought of their internet access time. And so these little JPEGs and the little GIFs, brought them home and started playing with them on my computer at home, printing them out on an old dot matrix printer, and then printed it as big as I could, and then wrapped it around my head as the world's worst, crudest version of virtual reality.
Well, did you dream, probably not then, that you would actually be working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory from whence those pictures came?
I certainly had no idea I'd ever end up working at JPL. Obviously, it would always have been a dream, but as someone growing up in the UK, I didn't really think that was something that could actually happen. But I was about to start a degree in electronic engineering at the University of Birmingham in England, and it was Pathfinder that kind of focused my attention on, okay, I want to go and work in the space business somehow. Now, my career is a story for another day, and it took many weird twists and turns, including almost 10 years working as a multimedia producer for a medical training company. But it set me on the path of wanting to follow these missions, of wanting to engage with these missions. And that is what ultimately led me to working at JPL just over 12 years ago. And even then, I didn't know I'd end up working on the Curiosity mission in the way I do today.
Okay, well, Pathfinder is perfectly named in a way, because it really did find a path for Mars exploration roving vehicles, didn't it?
It's a Pathfinder. It grew to live up to its name in a variety of ways. From an engineering perspective, it proved that ridiculous landing system of parachutes and retro rockets and those giant airbags that caused the spacecraft to kind of bounce and bounce and roll and bounce and roll and come to rest so it could, you know, start deploying. And that landing system was reused for Spirit and Opportunity just five plus years later. And then also little Sojourner was there to say, hey, you might not realize this, but one, driving around on the surface of another planet is now something we can do. And two, scientifically, that's really useful, because if you don't like where you are, you can just go look at something else. And so Spirit and Opportunity owe literally everything to Mars Pathfinder, and Curiosity owes everything to Spirit and Opportunity, and Perseverance owes everything to Curiosity. This lineage to the rovers we have today can be traced right back to Mars Pathfinder 25 years ago in the very literalist sense of the phrase.
Yeah. And of course, Pathfinder is no longer called that. Now it is Carl Sagan Memorial Station.
Yeah, and it was a fitting tribute, and it's a real shame that Carl never lived to see what Pathfinder became. He would have absolutely loved it. He would have so enjoyed following Mars Pathfinder, and I can only imagine what he'd have thought of Spirit and Opportunity and the missions that have come since. It was right up his street.
Yeah, he died the year before the mission. Okay, let's talk about something that really, to me, it hadn't occurred to me until I started to really think about it. And you mentioned it earlier that you were in England, and you know the internet wasn't everywhere. And in the 90s, you know, it's hard for a lot of us to remember back. It really wasn't, you know, we weren't a cell phone internet culture so much in the 90s. It was starting to happen, but it wasn't ubiquitous the way it is now. And conversely, the Mars Pathfinder mission was one of the first times that NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory really made a mission like fully available for you to check it out online and explore virtually along with. Could you talk a bit about that aspect?
It's crazy to think, you know, when you have a supercomputer sat in your pocket with access to all of the world's information from literally anywhere on the planet at any time, that's not always been true. And it really wasn't that long ago that you'd have to wait for the traditional media to get printouts of pictures from spacecraft to put in specialist publications before you'd see the new pictures from missions exploring the planets. And Pathfinder turned that completely around and said, we've now got this medium in which we can share everything we're doing day to day so the public can feel a part of this journey. Now, back then, like, we didn't have a cloud to go host all of this stuff. And so actually they were using mirrors, which were a phenomenon in early internet, having other companies host clones of the Mars Pathfinder website to try and spread the load around the world as best as possible. Like, the internet was not as robust and powerful as it is now. I believe that the amount of traffic on the then early internet to the Mars Pathfinder website was so huge, it actually broke the entire internet infrastructure of France.
Like, that's I remember that.
Yeah.
It broke the internet.
Pathfinder, and not just in the meme sense that we'd use today, in the actual physical sense, it broke the internet. And I think it was a perfect storm. Like, the internet was just beginning to flourish. It had kind of the slightly more techie audience were all dialed in. And this mission was so ready and so suited to being popular with that kind of crowd. It was a technology demonstration. There was cuteness of the Sojourner rover. There was a story from day to day. There was the drama of a mission that had, you know, a limited lifespan. And for three glorious months, the world could follow along through the internet. And in the same way that Pathfinder was a literal Pathfinder from an engineering and scientific point of view, it was also a Pathfinder from an outreach point of view, because every mission since has had to live up to, or try and live up to, and try and exceed that standard. And so it is thanks to the success and the creativity that Pathfinder's team took to share the story in real time. That is why we share our story. We shared it with spirit and with opportunity, and we do it with curiosity. We do it with perseverance. Every picture they take goes online the second it reaches the ground. And that's so true that literally yesterday evening, I was waiting for pictures from Curiosity that I had sequenced on the day before. And they were arriving at about 7:20 in the evening yesterday. And rather than going to my workstation and VPNing into the office and all of that, I just picked up my phone, went to the public website and saw the pictures there, because I knew they'd be there as well.
Yeah, it really is phenomenal that, you know, I know I can just grab my phone and often do this. And, you know, what's Curiosity doing right now? What is it seeing? Where is it at? And boom, there it is. And it didn't used to be like that. And then we should definitely mention Pathfinder has this great place in pop culture history. It plays a starring role in the movie The Martian.
It's wonderful, actually. It's always funny when, like, your robot heroes end up having a cameo in some plot twist. I have an incredibly funny story. We had some of the visual effects people who worked on The Martian visited JPL to talk about The Martian and where they got their resources to make the, and I thought, very good CGI representation of Mars, and ignoring the kind of the little scientific liberties that book takes, it's a beautiful tribute. It's a love story to science, and for that I adore it. And apparently on the movie set, they built a really nice copy of the Sojourner rover, and they put it in the hab, and the director said, I want it to move. And they said to Ridley Scott, well, in the book, it doesn't move. The rover is dead in the book. And so this is just a static model. He's like, I want it to move. And so the visual effects guys had to dress someone in a Lycra green suit with a piece of green string and pull this little model of Sojourner around that it looked funny. Like it was trundling around the habitat in the movie.
Oh, my. Because it really does seem like it's rolling around.
Yeah, it's a dude in a green jumpsuit with a piece of green string. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Hollywood magic.
And of course, the real stunt double for Sojourner, which is the Marie Curie rover, which is an almost exact duplicate, it was essentially the engineering model of Sojourner, now lives at the Air and Space Museum. At one point, it was almost going to fly to Mars in 2001 as part of a new mission that was unfortunately cancelled. And so Marie Curie ended up taking a ride to the Air and Space Museum, and it's going back on display after some refurbishments at the Air and Space Museum in DC, alongside the testbed rover for Spirit and Opportunity. And so you've now got these kind of the two most realistic models of these flight vehicles, because they are built out of the same stuff, you know, for the same reasons. parked next to each other at this Air and Space Museum. And I was at JPL literally yesterday looking at our Curiosity testbed rover, thinking, well, one day this will get to park next to them as well. And kind of this family portrait from Sojourner in the form of Marie Curie, and Spirit and Opportunity in the form of their testbed, which we nicknamed Dusty. And then Curiosity's testbed, which is known as Maggie, will all be kind of reunited as this family portrait at the Air and Space Museum, which seems like a very fitting way to celebrate kind of the lineage of these missions.
Well, on that lovely note, I'm going to thank you for sharing your thoughts and recollections about Mars Pathfinder, the first rover mission on Mars in 1997, landed on July 4th on Independence Day, and it just a spectacularly successful mission, and it's nice to see it getting its due now with all the great stuff going on at NASA.
Yeah, happy birthday. It deserves celebration. It was great to speak to you, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, Tom Swick, manager of the Space Technology Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, Dr. Sambit Bhattacharya, and his students, Collie Crawford and Grace Vincent from Fayetteville State University in North Carolina, and Doug Ellison, engineering camera team lead for the Mars rover Curiosity. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. If you missed or want to revisit an episode of Blue Dot, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. You can do that on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @BlueDotNSPR. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. I'm Dave Schlom, and for all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.